On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Most often we like to think that history is made by deliberate decision. But matter of fact, very often history is decided by stupid things, wrong turns, a misunderstanding of a communication, a lost set of plans, and on and on and on. Today, to talk to us about 100 mistakes that change history, backfires and blunders that collapsed empires, crashed economies, and altered the course of our world, is Bill Fawcett. His book is from Berkeley, which is a division of the Penguin Group USA. Bill, thanks so much for joining us on the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about some of my favorite goofy things that happen in American history first, since it's American History Month, but then we'll talk about some, because happily enough, not all of the 100 mistakes happen in America, which is kind of a relief, I think. Tell us about what made the Christmas at Trenton. How did this turn out to be one of the 100 mistakes that changed history?
Well, there probably wouldn't be United States except for a fella putting a note in his pocket. What was going on is it was a very, very low time for the American Revolution. They had lost 5 battles in a row through the summer and were at the infamous camp of Valley Forge, where the last 3,000 men directly commanded by Washington of the perhaps 7,000 under arms were camped in miserable condition, untrained, and with, on January 1st, about half of them going home because their enlistments were up. They had to do something, so they decided to go for the most hated group they could, which were the Hessian soldiers, who didn't even speak English. So they were used as the shock troops and as the counter-terrorist, really heavy guys by the British on the colonists. And there were about 1,200 Hessian soldiers in Trenton. Now, these were highly trained European professionals. But it was Christmas Day. And Christmas Eve, they decided to party because nobody fought during the winter. The weather was miserable. They were sure there was no problem. So let's say the schnapps ration was passed out with great liberal joy. And that was also including the officers, including Colonel Rahm, their commander, who was playing whist, which he had picked up from the British and had his officers doing, and drinking quite heavily. Now we've got Washington with his literally bedraggled band. Some of them really didn't have shoes. They had their feet wrapped. They didn't have enough shoes. They didn't have enough weapons. They were running light on everything. Not enough tents, not enough anything. And they got across the river. I rather doubt Washington stood up in his boat, by the way, because the biggest problem was ice floes. He'd have been knocked over. They got across the river, and they're marching up, and they go right past a farmer's house who is a British patriot. He's loyal to the crown, a Tory. And he takes one look at what's going on and goes, they're going for our good troops up in Trenton, our good Hessian boys. And he scribbles down a note, and he sends it up with one of his men riding ahead of the walking army. It's maybe midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, when the note arrives. But the colonel of the Hessians was probably feeling no pain. He was playing cards, he was partying, it was Christmas Eve, and he really didn't want to have to deal with reading a note from one of the locals. So instead of reading a note which said effectively, there's an army about to attack you, call out the guard, he shoved it in his pocket without reading it. Because he did that, the American troops got surprised. It was an incredible one-sided battle. When that happened, the American cause, the revolutionary cause, was revived. The British morale sunk. The men reenlisted. More men came. Von Steuben came and trained those men. And the American Civil War continued. The American Revolutionary War continued when just on the 24th or the 23rd of December, it looked like it was all over besides taking the surrender of the officers.
It certainly was a remarkable turnaround. And what made it happen was this fella just being too casual about a note and dismissing it as unimportant, sticking in his pocket to read it later.
Still in his pocket when he surrendered.
That had to make him feel kind of stupid, I'm thinking.
Don't think he returned to England with too many honors.
I would imagine not. Some of the other interesting situations that that occurred as a result of mistakes in American history, we're going to do them first since it's American History Month. One of them had to be, and this is in the book, 100 Mistakes That Changed History. This is mistake number 56, and that is kudzu. And let me tell you, here in the South, kudzu is just pernicious and ubiquitous. It is everywhere, and it has taken over everything. Many people wonder, how did we get kudzu? Because we know it's not native, or something would eat it or kill it. Tell us about the unpleasant surprise of kudzu.
Well, kudzu is a plant that grows on the mountains of Japan. It's another Japanese export that should have been recalled. You've got to think back to the Dust Bowl, when erosion was the enemy. It wasn't global warming, it wasn't invasive species, it wasn't any of this, it was erosion. And the government was looking around for a plant that would hold the soil, particularly in the South, in place. A plant that would grow quickly, have strong roots, and hold things where they're at. And they settled on kudzu. Kudzu didn't happen, we did it to ourselves. The U.S. government, during the period after the Dust Bowl and into the 30s with the WPA, paid to have 2 million acres planted in kudzu. Yes, the government paid people to plant kudzu.
Yike.
All over the South and Southwest. And then they had kudzu clubs, and they found out kudzu could feed animals, although they didn't like it much. And they had all, and they, there were articles in the PR campaign by the government on how wonderful kudzu was. Mm-hmm. And then one day in the late 30s, somebody looked around and went, whoops.
Wait a minute.
This isn't working out the way we planned. And within a year, they went from kudzu clubs and planting it to paying people to chop it up. You've seen how successful that worked out.
Yeah, yeah.
Today, there's an estimated 7 million acres completely engulfed by kudzu. It's now turned up in southern Canada, Italy, northern Australia, and a number of other unwanted places. And we're no closer to eradicating it we were now, or even finding something that will get rid of it permanently, because it grows so deep and grows so fast. You can almost watch it grow. Some kudzu plants can grow as much as 2 feet a day. A foot is not uncommon.
And I see, about the only thing around here that even will mess with the stuff is cows, but only if they're so hungry and there's no grass. So,
yeah, only if there's nothing else to eat. It doesn't
exactly
taste good to them.
Exactly. And they have to eat it like sheep do, all the way into the ground, which cows don't eat that way.
And even then, you've got some of them coming back, because kudzu roots can go as deep as 12 to 14 feet.
It's indestructible. It is the thing that will take over the planet.
It was designed to survive on the top of a mountain in lousy soil. When you put it in rich soil and with lots of warm and sunshine, it just went crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
But we did it to ourselves.
Yes, and this is something similar to this is the another one of the 100 mistakes that changed history, and that was prohibition. This is something we did to ourselves. It seemed at the time, I'm sure, like a really smart idea, you know, the noble experiment. Alcoholism was a real problem in America and so forth. And, well, the way to get rid of it was just to make alcohol illegal. The worst thing about prohibition is how it resulted in much worse crime, the attitude of lawlessness that it encouraged among people who never would have broken the law before.
What made prohibition a world-changing mistake, what introducing prohibition in this country, was not that people drank more or less. It was how they got it and what infrastructure it set up.
Mm-hmm.
Before this time, prohibition, there was very little organized major crime in the United States. There were some cities that had some gangs, like New York and things, but nothing like we saw. I'm from Chicago, so for Al Capone and his organization.
Yeah.
And in the effort to legislate an unpopular ban to eliminate alcohol, they simply opened the door. They forced illegality, effectively. They made being illegal almost acceptable, because it's where you could go to get your drink. It's where you went for entertainment. It's where you went to the nightclub, the speakeasy. And by doing so, It changed the face of this country.
Yeah.
It brought crime, it brought corruption to places it had never been all over the country before, and it enriched a class of criminals.
Mm.
Many of those criminals and those families are still around today. Some of them are still bad guys. Some of them are called the Kennedys.
Right.
In case anybody doesn't remember, Joe made a lot of money bringing scotch in from Canada and Scotland after he was ambassador to England.
Yes, he did. Just what a propitious appointment that must have been. We're talking, in case you're just now joining us, to Bill Fawcett, whose new book is 100 Mistakes That Change History, Backfires and Blunders That Collapsed Empires, Crashed Economies, and Altered the Course of Our World. It's from Berkeley Books. Bill, it doesn't take a whole lot of sense to realize that that Custer certainly has to be included in one of the real mistakes. And the sad thing is that Custer was a really, in the Civil War, was a great and courageous cavalry officer, but yet he and his wife were his best press agents ever, and nobody thought more of Custer than Custer himself, except maybe his wife.
Absolutely. He's a man who believed his own propaganda, but part of his propaganda was true. What people don't realize is that in the Battle of Gettysburg, Pickett's charge was supposed to have a cavalry charge coming in from behind. All of Jeb Stuart's cavalry, 2,000 men, were riding to hit the back of the Union line, which if they split would probably have allowed the Confederates to win that battle. 400 Michigan cavalry under George Armstrong Custer saw 2,000 Confederate cavalry coming up behind and charged. Held it up, five times their number, held them up heroically, took major casualties, fought them to a standstill at the front of their line until more Union cavalry came up, and Jeb Stuart decided it wasn't going to work. He was never going to get through, turned around, and left. He was one of the reasons we won the Battle of Gettysburg, maybe the major reason we won it, beyond Lee's many mistakes in the battle. Now we go out to Little Bighorn. It's peace. The army's demoted. He goes from general to colonel. He's got the 7th Cavalry. He's got to prove himself because Grant can be president, and then I can.
Mm-hmm.
I could be the youngest president of the United States. Look at me. I've got good blonde hair. He has tried for a year and a half to get the Indians to stand and fight. They always hit and run. It's the traditional tactic of the Sioux and of the various tribes there, the Cheyenne, and they hit and run. They don't stand and fight. So he's trying to get them to stand and fight. Now, remember, and we should keep in mind that the Little Bighorn was on Indian land.
Right.
We were taking it away from them yet again, having promised it to them forever because somebody found gold in the Black Hills. And so there were hundreds of miners going in and basically taking over the Indian land, and they went in to protect that and other interests. He's trying to get these Indians to fight, and he hears there's a big gathering. And boy, he was right. He just didn't realize it. And he is bringing his troops, and he says, I've got to trap them. So what he was doing then, that's what he was doing, is he was trying to avoid them running away again. So he split his command into three parts to surround them. The problem was he was outnumbered 4-5-1
right,
by the opposition. And then he split his troops. But he didn't know this at first. And that was his first mistake.
Right.
He didn't know that he was so badly outnumbered. His second mistake, and one that really you can't forgive him for, is he came over the hill, he looked down, and there are 2,000-plus teepees and wigwams, a gigantic camp. He's got 350 men with him, and there's 2,000-plus families down there. Well, as it turned out, there were about 3,000 warriors in the area, in fact. Instead of saying, well, discretion to valor, we'll get him another day, he led his troops in a charge towards the homes. Now, he's not charging soldiers. He's charging the women and children.
Right.
Well, the Indians see him and intervene, the braves in the area, and he gets diverted off. And then he forms up in the final location where he made his final, and it's a minor military mistake, rather than keeping his troops concentrated with a small area they have found in historical records that they spread into skirmish order 8 to 10 feet between each men and formed a big circle, thinking their firepower could keep it out. Had they been facing smaller numbers, that would have been a good strategy. But there just wasn't enough men to maintain the line at any one point, and it was quickly penetrated, overrun, and, of course, they lost to a man.
Yeah, yeah.
Might have helped, too, if he'd brought the 3 Gatling guns and the 4 cannon he was supposed to have, that because they didn't have good horses, he decided to leave behind.
We're talking to Bill Fawcett, the author of 100 Mistakes That Changed History, Backfires and Blunders That Collapsed Empires, Crashed Economies, and Altered the Course of Our World. It's from Berkeley Books, which is a division of the Penguin Group USA. One of the other mistakes in here is not one that we made, but that affected us. And that was mistake number 49, which was inviting the Americans to move into Texas because there was nobody living there. And the Mexicans thought, you know, wouldn't it be much easier just to invite the gringos down here and they can populate everything and we'll tax them. And it seemed like such a good system at first.
Texas was the northern outland, the Alaska for Mexico. Very thinly populated. They're having a lot of trouble with things like the Comanches who live there. And they were looking around on what to do. And they decided one of the things we'll do is very carefully and selectively, let's invite in some of the Americans to supplement our own population there. And they made the Americans agree to become loyal Mexican citizens and convert to Catholicism and pay taxes to Mexico and all that, to Mexico City and all that. And everybody who was there agreed. The trouble was that the Mexican government didn't really keep their side of the deal. They began becoming much more intrusive, much more vicious, and much more demanding, and then eventually decided that they weren't really comfortable with the gringos there after all. But it had been 20 years, and people like Sam Austin had imported thousands of families and made himself a small fortune doing it. So they kept pressuring them, and then they basically said, you can't have the rights that you had in the Mexican Constitution because we're throwing the Constitution out. Well, that didn't go over real big in parts of Mexico. It went over not at all in Texas among either the Mexicans or the Americans. You've got to remember that at the Alamo, as many people of Mexican descent died as many as there were gringos, as are people of U.S. descent. It was a general revolt against a dictator, and they did not like what he did, and he had already wiped out another entire province, had taken his army in and just killed it. And if you're going to repress a people, don't bring independent frontiersmen in and pay them and give them land to go live where you're going to try and repress later, I guess would be the best.
Yes.
Story.
Yes. Just as a cautionary tale to would-be people who might invite settlers, maybe not such a swell idea.
Didn't work so good for Rome inviting the barbarians to be troops or the Visigoths to settle inside their frontiers and then try to cheat them. I guess it's didn't work so good for them either. And of course, it began a period of antagonism that ended with Mexico effectively losing its northern third of the country to the U.S.
Right, and not only the northern third, but the northern third that actually was worth something, as it turns
California.
Out. This reminds me of the oft-quoted statement by George Santayana, those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And one of the things that happens in your book, 100 Mistakes That Change History, is time and again, a lot of people make the same dumb mistakes because apparently they never read the history of anybody that preceded them.
Book I'm currently working on is called Same Old Problems, Same Old Mistakes, and it's showing through history how this pattern is repeating and how we're just doing it again. The last person to control and successfully occupy Afghanistan was Alexander the Great. There have been about 8 failures since then.
Terrific. This is encouraging, isn't it? The chapter called Destroying Your Economy, it falls into this category to me. This is not American, but it certainly has echoes that reverberate for America. Now, this is a number 16 called And Denary Foolish. The mistake is using inflation to pay the bills.
Here's the situation.
Yeah, set it up for us.
And how it looks, parallels to today are appropriate. There was economic problems, there were business problems, and there were major programs that the emperor wanted. He wanted to rebuild portions of Rome, he wanted to build up the army, he wanted to create all these great monuments and buildings for him to be remembered by. He had social programs he had to support. By this time, most of the people of Rome were getting free bread. They were being supported by the state. There was over 1 million people in Rome. The trouble was, there wasn't enough money. Rome had made its money conquering other countries, and they'd run out of other countries that they could conquer. So for the last 70 years or so, the treasury wasn't getting massive infusions of British, Gallic, Eastern, Oriental, whatever, cash.
Yeah.
So he had to figure out a way to pay for this. Well, if the cost of a block of wood is 4 denarii, or a block of stone, let's say, of 4 denarii, and a denarii is so much silver, here's a way to make your silver go further. Let's put 10% tin in it. No one will tell the difference. Hey, that worked so good. Let's put 20% tin in it. And pretty soon, they're up to 80% tin in their silver, and it wasn't worth a denarii. The trouble is, people knew this. And so what you could buy with that denarii went away because they were, in effect, deficit spending. Think of that tin as borrowing against the future from other places. Because that's basically what he did. Is he said, someday these money will be worth more, but right now, take them, even though they're bogus, they're not worth what they say they are in silver. And everything was worth so much silver, so when you put less silver in your coin, you need more coins to pay for it, and you have inflation.
Yep.
And it's a pattern we see over and over in history, particularly either debasing the currency, which is what this is called, or once we got away from having a gold or silver-based currency, of course, you have the Weimar Republic, where they kept printing money to pay the government's bills and to pay off the war debt to France and everything after World War I, having lost it, and it broke Germany's economy. And the reaction to that was, of course, to bring in the Nazi Party,
right,
who said they'd fix things, which didn't work out so good for anybody. At one point, inflation, we talk about Rhodesia or Zimbabwe and their inflation, but at one point, inflation got so bad in Germany now, this is Germany in the 20s, that there is a story, probably true, of someone who went to a store to buy some groceries, and he had to take an entire basket of money. Well, he needed so much, he had to take two baskets. Well, he set one basket out in front full of money and ran in the store with the other to pay for what he'd gotten. And when he came back outside the store, the money was still there, but someone had stolen the basket. And that's what it literally became. Worthless. And
right.
It happened in this country. Not worth a continental used to be the phrase, because Continental Congress, when it couldn't pay its bills, simply printed more money without any gold backing it, and caused massive inflation, which was one of the biggest problems that Washington had to deal with when he took office.
Right, right.
And it happened again to the Confederate states. By the end of the Civil War, the Confederate money was valueless because they had printed so much of it to pay things that it had caused such massive inflation that it had, they destroyed their own economy from within.
I'm not sure who came up with this phrase, but it's certainly appropriate in this case. Insanity is doing the same thing time and again and expecting a different outcome.
I'm not sure either, but I certainly heard it, and most certainly that is a very valid statement on particularly this kind of economic activity.
Right.
To make things less expensive by inflating them only accomplishes one thing. It makes your debt relatively smaller because it's easier to pay off, but it destroys everybody's savings.
Right.
It destroys everybody's return. And if we get a massive turn of inflation while the banks are paying 1% to us, old people who used to live on their interest are now taking out from their capital, retired people.
Yeah.
Or the injured. It's going to go away quicker and quicker if there's inflation. So it is a very current social concern, which I see the Congress is maybe let's hope about to deal with.
Yes, hopefully somebody who read a history book got elected to Congress. Let's hope somebody did. So many of these guys.
I got a lecture on this about 12 years ago from Newt Gingrich.
You know, it's amazing to me. So many people go to Harvard and Yale and all these places and get elected. Did they not go to class? I mean, really?
I think they teach business and not history.
Apparently so. We're almost out of time, which is too bad because Bill's got so many fascinating chapters here. The one chapter about the crummiest presidents in American history, they all happen to be one after another between about 1840 to right up until the election of Lincoln.
Until Lincoln.
Yeah, there were some real losers in there, and I'm sure there were nice guys and their mamas loved them, but they were terrible presidents, and we just kept getting them
in
a room.
They were nonentities put in office because things were so tense nobody could agree to anybody competent. They didn't want anyone competent to hold the office. So they were putting nonentities in almost runs, and people that they didn't think would cause their side trouble could get in, but anyone with a strong stand or a lot of competence made too many enemies. And unfortunately, the price of inaction was the American Civil War and 500,000 dead and the country devastated.
Amazing. I love this. In 1856, the motto of the Democratic Convention was, and this is the Democratic Party, and Franklin Pierce is the Democratic president. The motto of the convention was, "Anybody but Pierce."
That's right.
Now, that's got to hurt.
And big banners on the wall.
And Pierce forgot to get they forgot to get him to ride in the inaugural parade, and it never even got to the inaugural parade of his successor.
No, he wasn't. No one thought to pick him up. He never got into it. He overslept, and nobody woke him up.
If only they'd done that when he was president.
Well, he didn't. He pretty much overslept through the presidency.
Absolutely.
What he did do was annoy people playing around with the economy.
Mm-mm.
He made it worse.
Lovely. Bill, fascinating book, 100 Mistakes That Changed History, Backfires and Blunders That Collapsed Empires, Crashed Economies, and Altered the Course of Our World. It's from Berkeley Books, which is a division of Penguin Group USA. Do you have a website where people can go to find out more about you and about your book and about the new one they're working on?
I have some podcasts on historymistakes.squarespace.com that they might enjoy.
All right. Very good.
And I will leave you with a quote you might enjoy by Carlos Santana again.
Okay.
Which is his follow-up to his one about mistakes, which is, "History are lies written by people who weren't there about things that may not have happened."
I'll have to share that with my wife, who's a math teacher. I think she'll appreciate that especially. Bill,
thanks
so much for being with us, and I hope your cough gets better. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll see you next Sunday morning at 9:30 on FM 94.7, Sunday afternoon at 2:30 on AM 970, and our website, WTBF.com. You might also check my new domain, which is onthebookshelf.biz, where we will archive several weeks' worth of On the Bookshelf programs in case you miss part of them and you want to go back and listen to the rest of them again. That should be available for you. So check that out, onthebookshelf.biz. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.